This recording is the from the Almagen Papers by Richard Rose, the first paper, and this is the part two of the first paper, pages 23 through 32. In this group of contributing individuals, we find Buddha, who sat alone for years. Christ meditated in the wilderness. Gandhi meditated in jail. Not only the saints and yogis found the need for isolation, but the life stories of many scientists, geniuses, and artists show them to have been recluses, at least during the incubation of their brain children. I am not so sure that man really wishes to be liberated from the frustrations of trying to guess the will of the zeitgeist in each of his daily actions. Herd living has become so complicated that each man despairs of ever finding relative sanity, let alone the ultimate reality. And he also knows that he may lose his life and all that he loves in the social cross-currents. He is able to continue living or to tolerate life by putting the serious thoughts as far back in the mind as is possible. He consciously encourages himself and his children to be sleepwalkers of sorts, sleepwalkers who will act out meaningless lives just to be allowed to be mobile vegetables. In other words, if you act like the rest of the herd, you will be allowed your bread, your roof, and the right to procreate. Man compensates for his frustrations by posing. In this, he does not revert to the womb, but only to childhood and to childish mechanisms for pretending. By pretending a bit or a lot, he is able to make his robot existence more bearable. But by this make-believe, he thrusts himself so far from the urgency of figuring out the labyrinth that he simultaneously closes every avenue of spiritual awakening. We are unaware of this life of make-believe simply because we live it as reality. Yet hardly any labor or habit is without affectation. We feel exalted by soap and water. We don a clean or new outfit and find ourselves walking a bit straighter, using more careful grammar, possessing more elan, more courage, and more dignity. We view ourselves in the mirror and are utterly amazed at any previous conviction of our own insufficiency. A pair of spectacles may induce a contemplative, scholarly attitude, even though the wearer is illiterate. Mascara may paint tiger stripes on a kitten. A head filled with hideous thoughts and distorted in shape may appear angelic if properly coiffured. Perfume and suggestive clothing contribute to cranial confusion both in the wearer and in the observer. The one who plays the act and poses is intoxicated by flattery, and he or she who receives the flattery interprets the flattery as a fiat of validity for the act of pretense. Sometimes the observer is likewise intoxicated, so intoxicated, in fact, that he has been known to change religion, philosophy, or his way of life in the twinkling of an eye, and even risk his life in the process of encouraging the make-believe and in enforcing it upon his fellows. The nudists have a point. There are enough mysteries to be solved without the creation of more by men. A white tunic does not make a doctor, nor a uniform a general. Strip the populace naked, and you will have trouble determining the professional or the fools. Drunkards would be mistaken for priests, and truck drivers would look like business executives. When stripped, the proud would become humble. The judges would appear as furtive as perverts and thieves. The exhibitionistic sex offenders would probably be the most at ease. The clergy would lose their mask of austerity, and the pedant would begin to stutter. Only the man who has a deep inner conviction and a true set of values would remain the same. Vanity and the desire to force respect determines the type of vehicle we drive and the type of house we own. And these possessions should remind us that vanity is compatible with obsolescence, for which we pay an endless price. The world will not change its vanity, even though 100 books are written about it. It may evolve toward a more stable self-appraisal, but not swiftly. Since it takes poverty to realize the importance of wealth, it is equally possible that the pinnacle of wisdom extends from a pyramid of ignorance and despair. Our bicameral brain and its sensory duality may also be symbolic of the polarity of all comprehension, so that no thing is fully understood until all things relative to it are understood, including its opposite. So that in a way all things have their place and purpose, but it is not prohibited for a mind to understand this polarity and to rise above it automatically. The social illusions are by no means the only illusions. The worst illusions, those most difficult to overcome, are the religious, philosophic, and scientific illusions. More astute and complex minds draw the blueprints for religious and scientific illusions, and consequently, they create a more complicated labyrinth. And as we penetrate these, we find that the different sets or kinds of illusions interpenetrate one another and thus increase complexity and frustration. There comes a time within the lifetime of nearly every man when he is aware of the nonsense of life, but unfortunately this time comes at about the time of death. The knowledge only comes with a degree of relinquishment. The whole cobweb of illusion finds roots in the impressionable mind of man and is bound to his being by strong motivating forces, sometimes called instincts, or emotional drives, and which I would prefer to label as implants. Love is one of these, and it probably holds man in slavery more surely than any of the other bonds. We begin by thinking that love is something which we possess, and soon find that it possesses us. Next, we recognize it as a sort of capacity for identification with our fellows. We identify in this manner with our mates, our parents, children, and friends. And we think it quite an exalted quality or ability. That which we find out later is that we seek out these relationships and create them where there is no reciprocity, real reciprocity in kind. We can assume that man wishes to be loved, and that most of his protests of love toward other beings, if analyzed, would prove to be frantic pleas for attention. This hunger for attention provokes all sorts of concessions and promises from the protester of love. And, of course, the most absurd protestation emanates from the mouth of egotistical pretenders who announce their love for God and his love of them. Such a pronouncement has double jeopardy in that it uses the two most misused words in the human language, love and God. Both have too many interpretations. Love can be taken to mean gentle hypnosis, sex, lust, the habit of reciprocal sex, or self-indulgence, which uses another person as a mirror. It is difficult for a person to free himself from the seeming need for love. Man does not enjoy love more than he suffers from it and is used by it or by the forces that implanted love within him. And as he becomes aware of his love's slavery, he merely transfers the love hunger to another object. He is very slow to give it up entirely. When sex love is dissipated, the attachment will turn to children or grandchildren. Sex pleasure is often replaced by the enjoyment of a feeling of nobility in being both more feeble and more extroverted. Sometimes an old person refuses to let go of his or her ideas of lovableness, even with the aid of senility. inhuman legality. It has been said that Karl Marx and Cotton Mather both agreed on one thing, namely that the common man, the masses, is incapable of governing himself. The common man, whether he drinks from the paps of patriarchal monarchy, stern communism, or undisciplined democracy, is still like a puppy in an unweaned state. He has implicit faith in the breasts of that parent. He can be abused and beaten, but he will protect that parent with his life. And it is doubtful if his masochism will ever be erased. Individual parents prepare their children for the future role of masochist because state entities are inclined toward the purging of individualists who might attempt to reform the brutality of the state. It is easier to make masochists out of children than to see them electrocuted or hung. So we begin by paddling them with a sort of clandestine and sinister gradualism, finally work up to whipping and beating. I have repeatedly heard local school teachers describe the procedure used to induce a child to take his cracks without panic or rebellion. They hit him with less severity at first so that the surprise is gradual. Conditioning of the body to assault. The pupil may even give his consent to being cracked, presuming that there will not be any increase in the severity of the blows. By the time the pupil is a man, he is no longer a man. He has conditioned himself to being on the receiving end of blows. Now he is no longer spanked, but is now kicked, clubbed by rifle butts in service training, and clubbed by the local police. For failing to act in a cringing manner before some uniformed sadist, he can be clubbed into insensibility or suffer excruciating penalties. I know of two cases where men who had been clubbed by city police never regained their sanity, and they spent the rest of their lives in the asylum. But these are only the evident cases of brutality, and some sensitive souls bemoan this disease of civilization which divide all men into two classes, sadists and masochistic sadists, so that manhood is suppressed and suspended with always the hope that somewhere in the future the little masochistic boy will grow up to be a sadist. The fraternity or sorority pledge pays with pain now for the purpose and license of causing pain later. Sensible parents know that there is no top sadist. There is only an endless circle of people beating one another. Here and there, an egotistical sadist overplays his part, thinking he is above the club. But the circle goes on. The man who invented the guillotine died on it. The general is spanked by the Secretary of the Army, and the Secretary is spanked by Congress. And members of Congress take turns spanking one another, consigning an occasional member to jail, banishment, or ruin for hiding unregistered graft. And a few parents, seeing all of this, have decided to bring their children up without beating them, hoping that perhaps their example will inspire others, until masochism will be absent from the motivational needs of mankind. They may produce unusual children, but not enough to put the rest of mankind to shame, which would be necessary to stop the brutality. And so the madness goes on, and subconsciously all of humanity is so ashamed of brutality that no one will even admit that it goes on. And the result is that even as a nation we react as a masochist. We beat our own soldiers and shoot them for killing the enemy. We run all over the world apologizing for engaging in competitive business or for offending some petulant group. Religion helps us with any difficulties which we might have in being good masochists. We are reminded of the glories of being struck on both cheeks. I cannot see too much difference between the schoolteacher who terrifies with the board or rattan and the judge who threatens with the gavel. Perhaps you think that we do not live under abuse. If you have this attitude, it may mean that your turn has not yet come. You have not yet been sentenced by a jury of peers. And, of course, no one is sentenced by peers. Peers do not condemn. They commiserate. While the actor who plays the part of the beater beats us, he consoles us by telling us that we have rights. This makes us feel like the beating has some meaning. Haphazard jurisprudence now has a meaning, but any of us can, within a half hour after leaving our homes, find that our vast catalog of rights has dwindled down to one last right, and it is handed to us as a beneficence. It is the right to make a phone call after being arrested. We have the right to go to bed, but not to sleep in peace, nor to defend our families. If a firebomb comes through your window, you must, while putting out the fire, overcome and identify the arsonist without hurting him, and then proceed via legal channels. And when you discover the efficacy of these legal channels, you will laugh all the way to the courthouse and back. You have the right to legal counsel if you are willing to put all of your worldly possessions in his hands. Even our children know of the farce that is imposed under the subterfuge of justice. They do not know the details, but they know the deck is stacked. They look into the faces of judges and see senility and often insanity, depravity, or an incurable vascular condition caused by alcohol. Alcohol has been discovered to be a whipping palliative. It makes the whip more bearable. And, of course, the judge and many aspiring barristers cannot forget the slogans issued to them in their masochistic youth, because at one time they were under the whip and had to be convinced of its right. The result is that the judge has a strong subconscious conviction that he should be whipped. By all the rules, he has sinned. He has taken graft, or at least let his friends off easier than the friendless victims who stood before him. Perhaps he has broken traffic laws and the troopers recognized him and turned their heads. This robot expects a whipping, but no one comes forth to whip him, and the fact that he has wielded the whip leaves him with the apprehension that his term may come at any time. He waits and it does not come, and so unconsciously he punishes himself. He drinks and then punishes himself by drinking more and more. Is the great programmer up there in the sky a subtle sadist? Does he feel that this endless punishment of flesh and mind is necessary to prevent the flesh from precipitating into apathy and inertia? Momentarily, we are aware of our superior status to the animal. The animal is beaten by stronger species, while man is programmed to beat himself. And so the ritual of flagellation is not confined to the flagellantes or cloistered monks who, in dreary circles, tramp, pray, and whip the monk ahead. All humanity walks a similar treadmill in confusingly interlocking circles, all fustigating, all in turn fustigated. And therein lies our only equality, perhaps. Our common denominator is found in mutual misery and helplessness. Each of us is but the space in the circle between two whips. And perhaps this sick orbiting will not be stopped until all of society grows tired of it at about the same time. And when men largely and quietly realize that toadstools have more chance of possessing equality with other toadstools than do humans. Simply because the more complex and evolved an organism is, the greater the possibility of variety and consequent inequality. Of course, there is always an escape from whipping. It is suicide. And suicide may be slow. It may be a heart attack when the body can stand no more. It may be insanity when the mind simply cannot tolerate any more nonsense, but is not able to plan a suicide. The alternative is mental retreat. The more masochistic humans die quietly. Those who thought they were the masculine aggressors are those who are more likely to end it all with an extremely violent form of self-punishment. The general, whose monumental ego had to be matched with monumental power, commits suicide when his whip arm is paralyzed. The psychiatrist goes crazy, cooked in his own pot. The financier is also inclined to suicide. Suicide is the supreme punishment for superior people. No one is good enough to whip the king but the king himself. It is possible that the only men who might be considered beyond sadism and masochism are those who die on the scaffold. This would apply only to those who are convicted for killing the whipper, thus knowingly removing themselves from the circle of sickness. Semantics. We may smile or tremble at the King of Liars, who sits on his bench and orders us to tell not only the truth but the whole truth, especially when we know the implications of that order. The whole truth would give us all the secrets of the universe. And regardless of all the misery that is caused to the private citizen by the abuse of words at the hands of his bandit chiefs, this misery cannot compare to the trouble that we run into in sincere spiritual searching, simply because we have to deal with inadequate language or the deliberate misuse of terms which otherwise might be adequate. Many books on transcendentalism leave us confused because of difficulties with their terms. We are aware of the glibness with which some words, such as God, truth, heaven, and love, are used, and we are aware of the bloody battles that have been fought for the difference of definition. Before understanding any treatise of length, we must first sense and intuit the author's meaning for his terms. It will do us little good to look in the dictionary. Each book has its own little cosmos, the meaning of which we must sniff out, guess, or interpret from the general text, and at the end we must be satisfied with the author's sincerity if we can detect it. Some words have several connotations, all of which is added to meaning possibilities arising from inference and interlinear hints. And on the other side of the fence, we have words that seem to have no meaning at all, except to a very limited number of people. For instance, Satori has no meaning that can be described. It has meaning only for those who have experienced a certain state, and for those who have experienced it, it apparently has different meanings. The curse of Babel is truly upon us, and especially upon those who look to heaven. Let us take the words soul, mind, spirit, astral body, superego, oversoul, universal mind, Brahman, Purusha, chakra, and self. Now, if we admit these items to be real characteristics of human beings, we must also admit that many must be a very complicated character because no two of them is defined as synonymous. We might take the last word, self, to use a word for comparison. Writers use the word profusely but rarely identify it. The self may mean the body, the personality, the individual soul as distinguished from other souls or soul environments, or it might be synonymous with the word Atman. It might even be used to explain the superego or the mind. The materialist might be describing the body when he uses the word self. The modern sociologist defines the self as such visible evidences as emotions, thoughts, and sensations. No one has bothered to define thinking before making it part of the self. Infallible science, when applied to unprovable psychological concepts, simply tightens up the circle. Thinking is defined as the function of the mind, and the mind is defined as that part which thinks. We have two more words which are the luxury of idiots and authoritative men. They are right and wrong. Right is luck, and wrong is unluckiness. Right is today, but wrong is tomorrow. Right is strength, wrong is weakness. Right is a voted mandate. Wrong is wisdom possessed by a few. Or right is the wisdom of the few, and wrong is the weakness and delinquency only of those who know the truth. There are two words, life and death, which have obscure meanings. Life is seeming motion, and death is cessation of action. Life is awareness, and death is oblivion. Yet it can be demonstrated that life may well be semi-awareness or fractional awareness, and that death may bring us to reality and real activity.